From the Sky News Centre at 6. Within the last hour, a 14-year-old boy has been charged with attempted murder after a teacher was stabbed at Dixon's King's Academy in Bradford yesterday. He'll appear at Bradford Magistrates Court tomorrow. The grandmother of a boy who's gone missing with his mum has been jailed for 10 days for lying about their disappearance. Louise Minnick's partner, Andrew Butt, has been sentenced to 28 days for helping Rebecca Minnick go on the run over a bitter custody battle. The father of a British tourist arrested for posing naked on a Malaysian mountain says her sentence is appropriate and fair. Eleanor Hawkins and three others are being deported after spending 3 days in custody. Each will also pay a £1,000 fine. Our reporter Mark Stone in Malaysia has spoken to the Tourism and Culture Minister, who initially claimed their actions caused a nearby earthquake.
A reference there to the tribal and cultural beliefs in this part of Borneo, but he made it very clear when we spoke to him that he'd already received quite a few calls from people he knows, from the public, saying that they believe the sentence should have been much, much worse.
A children's cancer doctor who abused 18 boys in his care has had his 22-year jail sentence restructured. It means Miles Bradbury could serve less time in jail but will face more stringent measures to prove he can be released. Gordon Brown and Nick Clegg have been among hundreds of mourners who've attended the funeral of former Lib Dem leader Charles Kennedy. He died last week aged 55 after a long battle with alcohol. A service was held in his hometown of Fort William. David Green was Mr Kennedy's researcher.
What I remember him for was his wit, his humour. Even in the darkest times, he was someone who could make us all laugh, and particularly on a day like this, I miss him greatly. He would have made us smile.
That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
When all those media moguls, the bankers, politicians have been meeting together since 1954, not one of them was able to spot the recession coming. Or maybe they caused it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Top of the Bilderberg agenda, TTIP and TPP, these trade deals that let the corporations sue governments if the laws hurt their profits, otherwise known as the privatisation of democracy. Ever wonder why what our governments do benefits big corporations and not us? Our future's being decided for us this weekend over in Austria at the annual Bilderberg Conference, where the elite of the West consolidate their plans to extend power over the next year and give instructions to the pliable politicians as to how they want our taxpayers' money to be spent. This year's Bilderberg meeting is taking place in an interesting region of Europe, supposedly neutral Austria. But the corporation with most staff there is actually Google, reflecting the criminal elite's increasing interest in owning and controlling that technology. The so-called technocracy. NATO's power elite want to know all about us through total information awareness, surveillance to you and me. But any journalist that tries to report from the exclusive Interalpen Hotel near Innsbruck can expect to be harassed, body searched again and again, and even arrested for no reason. They don't want the world to know anything about what they're plotting. Martin, it's a marked increase this year with three Google executives there. And this, I find, is something a little bit disturbing about this, because this technology is really important. There's this basic hypocrisy here. We've known through the Edward Snowden revelations that the National Security Agency and GCHQ and other signals intelligence services are gathering vast amounts of data about everything we do, things like mobile phone records, emails, this kind of thing, and they're putting it through these kind of programs which process the information. They're then putting those into databases. When they bring up our personality, whoever we are, then there's a whole load of information about who we are, what we like, what we do. This information then is available for marketing, that kind of thing. And also then there's what they call the Internet of Things, where the internet is slowly coming further and further into our homes through things like smart meters, even smart toasters that are talking to a smart meter which is connected somewhere to the internet. This kind of thing is happening more and more. Our cars, we've done quite a lot about this over the last 18 months or so. The computers on our cars are hackable, so it's quite feasible, and in fact people have done this, that they can steer a car from the back seat of the car using a smartphone. We've even had the controlling of aircraft from within the aircraft, and demonstrations that aircraft are actually quite easy to hack and you can take over from the pilot. They are really interested in getting into everywhere, and yet at this particular meeting over in Austria, they don't want us to know anything about what they're talking about at all. And these are the people who are responsible for most of the money in the Western world and the biggest industrialists there are.
Well, yes, I mean, the fact that they're spying on us is worrying, but of course, you know, in a way, there's not a lot we can do about it. But of course, the fact is that these people are in fact criminals and terrorists, and that's much more serious. So they're not spying on us for any kind of positive purpose. They need to find out what's going on so that they can neutralise their opposition. And I believe that NATO intelligence infrastructure is intimately involved in things like Islamist terrorism, for example, in Syria and elsewhere.
You say there's nothing we can do about it, but actually what GCHQ have been doing is breaking the law, because to do this surveillance, you have to go to court and get a court order. Well, now, what's happening is in a bit of a sort of sticking plaster bit of legislation in the Queen's speech, what they're going to try and do is to say, oh, well, actually, all this stuff that was in the past, which was criminal, we're going to bring it within the law.
Yes, and of course, you can't really do that.
But it doesn't stop those those acts in the past being crimes, does it?
No, it doesn't. But of course, nor does it stop things like 9/11 being crimes. But those they are crimes as well, and carried out by, in my considered opinion, by elements within our own security forces.
Well, why do people get so het up though about having their emails read and this kind of thing?
Well, it's in the original American Constitution. In 1776.
But why is it there? Why is it there?
It's there because they said that one of the things we are fighting the British for is we don't want anybody looking at our private communications unless there is a warrant. In other words, we are investigating a crime. Otherwise, the state has no business looking into people's private mail of any kind.
So what's the danger? What's the danger? This is what I'm trying to get to.
Well, I mean, the original American revolutionaries believed that the state should be small.
Okay.
In principle, it should not have powers if it didn't need to have them.
What about today, though? Why should we be worried about people reading our emails, or should we?
Well, we should be, but it's very difficult to... I mean, obviously, the ways round this... I mean, the Provisional IRA used to operate in what was termed the electronic cage. You can imagine they were under constant surveillance all the time, both electronically and otherwise. But somehow, they managed to nearly kill two British Tory prime ministers. How did they do that? Well, they didn't do it by being too chatty on the phone, I don't suppose.
One of the BBC actually did a very good survey of all the participants at this year's Bilderberg. Most were from the United States, by far the highest number, about 35, I think it's 34 people from the US. The next nearest was Britain, then France and Austria. Obviously, Austria being the host country is going to be kind of schmoozed. The whole point of them being in Austria is to schmooze the Austrians and say, well, actually, you know, the Western elite are the great guys, the big, you know, the roof that you need to look after Austria. But then if you start looking at the backgrounds of the participants, finance is number one. I mean, that's quite clear. I mean, there are a few royals there. I think one of the most interesting things is Queen Beatrix. She's abdicated, and yet she still goes to the Bilderberg conferences. So that's a bit bizarre, isn't it? Could it just simply be it's about her shareholding in Royal Dutch Shell?
Possibly, but don't forget what we were talking about in the first hour, the links between the Dutch royal family And the setting up of Bilderberg with Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, the ex-Nazi.
And the Nazis, oh gosh. Okay, so finance, let's look at the main four sort of groups of people who were there, where we're talking about, 25, 26, 27, 18 of each group. But first of all, finance, obviously, this is the people who control most of the money in the Western world are financiers, and they seem to be the real heavyweights here. Then we've got politicians. For a large part, politicians are being schmoozed. They're being told this is the best way to go, this is the best way to do things. But then we've also got media as well, is the next one down. So many. We've got 18 participants from the press, and yet they are when they walk into that building, they're told, well, you're not allowed to actually say what's been going on here and reference it to any specific person. You can say, I think this is good and this is good, whatever, but you're not allowed to say that you heard it here or that who specifically was telling you.
This is what's called Chatham House rules, where you can quote, but you can't say who said it and so on. But in any case, the media are in there to make sure that they don't report it. All the top media executives are in there to make sure that they're underlings do not report what's said. Can I also add that I'm fairly convinced that there will be people who are in that meeting who are not on the list. There will be others attending that meeting who we don't know who they are.
Well, we know, for example, that Hillary Clinton went to a Bilderberg a few years ago, and at Barack Obama, and they weren't on the list. We also know that the previous one to take place in Britain before Watford, which was a couple of years ago, that's Turnberry in Scotland back in 1998. We had Tony Blair there. He wasn't on the list. So the other person on my big guess for who might be there and not on the list is David Rockefeller, because his 100th birthday is just this weekend.
Well, he may,
and he's one of the main people. I mean, he's at just about every single Bilderberg.
The
he's
point
also
is a secretive organisation like this, you cannot presume that the list they give out of who's attending is a full and complete list. It probably isn't. Some people are probably happy to be on the list. Others who are attending probably don't want them to be known that they are there. So, you know, they're under no obligation to tell us anything about who's on the list. So we may be being misinformed.
So let's go through some of the things that have come out about this year's Bilderberg conference. In Austria, sabotaging neutrality is surely a more effective accusation than criminality. Actually, there's a lot of feeling in Austria amongst ordinary people and many press and commentators that neutrality is absolutely key to Austrian life. And they don't take kindly to being told, actually, you should be more friendly with the West. But they are, of course, very, very close to the Germans, who are part of NATO. And we've got police that have been the same police unit from Germany that was policing the G7. It's the same police unit policing this the Bilderberg, just 20 miles away.
Interestingly enough, the South Stream pipeline, which is being proposed by the Russians to run from the Turkish-Greek border through the Balkans and ultimately to Austria, it's supposed to terminate in Austria, and then the gas will be distributed around the European Union. But the Austrians, up to now, have been very keen for this to go ahead. But I can imagine that there's an enormous, if you listen, people listen carefully outside the hotel, they will hear the sound of arms being twisted and testicles being crushed in order to make sure that they don't sign up for the Russian proposed South Stream pipeline. Of course, it's not in Austria's interest not to sign up. But then, is Austria powerful enough to take on the rest of the Western alliance? We'll have to see.
There's a whole list of things they'll be talking about, including the whole sort of technology surveillance, that sort of thing, as well as East-West relations. One of the things on the list is just the United States. Another one is just Russia. Obviously, they're not telling us a lot about what they're going to be saying, but we can kind of guess. But one thing, Martin, is there's no mention of world hunger, inequality, at all in the conference. Actually, this is one of the biggest problems in the world, and they're not even talking about it.
Well, this is strictly for the big boys, isn't it? And it's big boys rules, big boys conversations. Are they interested in solving these problems? The answer is no, they're not. So there's not really much point discussing them, is there?
The best place, I think, to follow what's been going on there online, and I'm not sure, I don't think these articles have been in the actual Guardian newspaper, is the Guardian website and Charlie Skelton's Builder blog, where he's been blogging away. He's down there having a bit of harassment from the police after being schmoozed and looked after the G7. One of the articles he's done is called "At the G7, We Journalists Were Pampered. At Bilderberg, We're Harassed by Police." And there's a picture on there of what looks like a sort of a kind of olive green army truck with a giant radar on the top of it. Now, he's saying that speculating anyway, this is some sort of local radar to stop people with hang gliders gate crashing the conference. And you know, there's a massive amount of security down there, but some bright spark has pointed out this isn't actually a radar at all. It's some kind of riot control active denial system, they call it, to stop any protesters getting near. Now this is a microwave on the dish on the top of the truck that they actually point at a crowd, and it makes everybody in the crowds their skin burn. Basically, it's a microwave beam. It's like being in a microwave oven.
Well, yes, and of course, there's not that many people. I mean, what I think is very significant is they seem to be trying to prevent journalists from reporting from the conference. And of course, we were expecting that Charlie might be phoning us, but I have read that they have been basically, it's almost impossible to get a telephone signal anywhere near the conference.
Well, I spoke to Charlie on Wednesday, and he said he'd give us a call, but we haven't had a call from him. May still get one. We just don't know. And if we do, we'll take it. But he's there on the scene, and there's some sort of device called a Stingray, which the InfoWars people have taken a photograph of, which apparently is used to disrupt. I mean, we've no idea whether Charlie just run out of power on his phone battery. We just don't know. But this is definitely there, this thing which is used to disrupt communication.
Yes, and he's generally a reliable fellow, so I suspect that they're making it as difficult as possible. You'd have thought, as he points out in the article, at the G7, the journalists are given every facility because they want their message to go out and they want the world to know what wonderful chaps they are, blah, blah, blah. At Bilderberg, they just want to crawl into a corner and get on with their business without being disrupted.
Well, Charlie's doing quite a good job anyway for The Guardian on doing that. The most of the attendees arrived yesterday. Now it's also called a heat ray, this thing that he's taken a photograph of. I'm not sure if Charlie actually realised what this thing was. Crowd dispersal cannon, active denial system, and the Stingray thing as well. They're obviously really trying to make sure that they've all virtually been a paramilitary kind of defence network, even though there's only a handful of people actually there covering it.
Well, yes, and it's all paid for by the Austrian taxpayer, even though this is supposedly a private meeting. Incidentally, Osborne is there, and if Osborne is there as a representative of the British government, in other words, he's in work time, and a few years ago he went to one of these meetings, said, oh, it was a private meeting, therefore I don't have to report back, but he'd taken his top civil servants with him, who were definitely not there, who were definitely there in work time. Now, I would argue that if some politician goes to this meeting in work time, I want to know what they're talking about. Otherwise, I want to be able to say you can't go.
Anyway, we'll be speaking to Charlie, even if we don't manage to talk to him tonight during the week, and let you know what the situation was next Friday. Now, also, Martin, we've heard police are stopping anybody who's not invited getting anywhere near the venue. That is to say, if they get stopped by the police, they get a €500 fine just for driving near the place. That's 360 quid.
Well, it's quite interesting, actually, because the policing of Bilderberg has varied enormously depending upon where it is. I mean, the Watford police a couple of years ago when we went down, when they were in Britain, were as helpful as they could be in the circumstances, although there was a massive amount of private security who were undermining the police's policing of what was going on. I think in Austria, you've got a rather paranoid mentality in the police. When they were in Catalonia, the local police were very helpful to people who wanted to.
Is it really paranoia, or are they actually part of a kind of almost what's become a privatised police system, which is working for the corporations, not for the government?
Well, indeed, but I think that in actual fact, the policing of Bill, and of course, what happened in Watford in the end is that the local police. Police authority ended up paying more than half the cost of it. That, in other words, the taxpayers, council taxpayers of Watford, ended up paying for what is essentially a private meeting. Now, this is
a private meeting of criminals.
Of criminals, yes. Because, of course, the main allegation against Bilderberg is that criminal activities are cooked up there. So the former, the current head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, wrote a book about the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, and he was an investigating magistrate on many of the cases. And in the press in Italy, he said, well, I think that the Bilderberg group were behind that terrorism. And he named the Bilderberg group as the main suspects.
Well, one of Charlie's Bilder blog articles is entitled Bilderberg 2015, Where Criminals Mingle with Ministers.
And some of the ministers are criminals. I think what we've now got developing is a criminalised oligarchy. Now, in many respects, this is extremely worrying, but it shows quite clearly, I think, what the way forward is. These peoples are criminals in the sense that they have Interpol files and that they are, in fact, engaged in illegal activities. Like the banks, for example, engaged in massive illegal activities. Now, of course, what happens is they plead guilty, they get a slap on the wrist. But the fact is that they've admitted that they are criminals.
So, Charlie's had a look at the Bilderberg list and realised that some... I mean, there's one, for example, he was lecturing some of the Austrian police, saying, actually, you know, some of the people in there are criminals, and they're sort of slightly embarrassed. As they're searching him and harassing him, René Benko, Charlie told the cops, the Austrian real estate baron who had a conviction for bribery recently upheld by the Supreme Court, which didn't stop him making a cut for this year's conference. You know Benko? The cop nodded. It wasn't easy to see the glare in the searchlight, but he looked a little ashamed.
Well, that's right. And I think the way forward is for the civilian police force to grow a pair and recognise that the protesters aren't the problem. The people inside the wire are the problem. And we need to see some of these people doing perp walks and being sent to prison for life. The terrorism in Italy in the 70s and 80s killed hundreds of people. Somebody has to pay the price for that.
As Charlie was reeling out these various lists of criminals, and I mean, I don't think he even got to HSBC, who was it? I can't remember, 20 million dollar, hang on, I cannot remember, it was in the billions anyway, the fine they got for money laundering. These guys are in there. There's two of the chiefs of HSBC. Now, we've had this big hoo-ha this week with HSBC telling George Osborne, basically, you know, we're threatening to leave the country. Also, we're sacking loads of people. Guardian called them the bank with no shame.
Well, indeed, and these are the people calling the shots, and we bailed them out. And therefore, far from being ashamed or in any way contrite, they are making even bigger power plays than they made before. But ultimately, as I say, the Italian Supreme Court and the Italian police force have already pointed the finger at Bilderberg as an originator of terrorism. Now, at some point, the police have got to start doing their job, which isn't harassing protesters.
Now, the daddy, really, it has to be said, at Bilderberg has got to be Henry Kissinger, the guy that comes back year after year, former Secretary of State under Richard Nixon. I mean, I know he was involved in, for example, the covert bombing of Cambodia, which is quite clearly a war crime, and he was also, which certainly wasn't approved by the UN, and also toppling Allende in Chile, I think it was 1975, and the coup that brought Pinochet to power. I mean, this man is quite a serious, and there are places in the world where if he steps off a plane, he's going to be arrested. He is like treated like royalty here.
Well, yes, and I think the fact is, you see...
And actually, he's chatting with royalty, isn't he? Well, drinking
over
royalty.
The years, evidence eventually piles up. If you remember, we had some extracts from the BBC Panorama programme the other week about the British Army's role in hundreds of murders in Northern Ireland. And as one of the participants in the programme said, in this modern days of the internet, this is not going to go away. All of the evidence is available to anybody who carries out a Google search. And sooner or later, we're going to catch these people and the evidence is piling up against them. And once you see what happened in the Mani Pulite investigations, the clean hands investigations in Italy in the 90s, is once you start arresting some of these elite criminals, a tidal wave of popular revulsion means that you can start arresting more of them. And ultimately, I see the future of these people as being in a whole new generation of maximum security prisons run by democratic countries.
Now, we did talk, didn't we, earlier on about the lot of technology firms there with three people from Google. Google DeepMind, this is Demis Hassabis, He's there. And Regina Duggan, the former head of DARPA, turned Google executive, as well as Eric Schmidt, who's the Google boss. So why do you think they're so interested in Google? I mean, I'll give you my view first, actually, which is Bill Gates was very much friendly with the intelligence community and the bankers back in the 1970s and 1980s when Microsoft was first starting. Now, this is the operating system which everybody needs to use if they're going to use a computer. Now, it seems to me Google is kind of sitting on top of Microsoft as the big interface with the public, which has got all the information in it, our emails, our search data. And these Bilderbergers and the bankers want these people on side.
Well, yes, and I think in actual fact, my analysis of this would be somebody like Bill Gates is essentially chosen to be the head of Microsoft. The internet only develops because of massive investment by the American military-industrial complex. That it won't work at all until you've got a massive infrastructure in place. And so all of the initial sunk costs were paid for by public sector investment, mainly of a military nature. And at a certain point, you then want to hand it over to a reliable private sector operator, and that would be Bill Gates. And of course, we're presented as these people being these kind of entrepreneurial geniuses. And I would argue that in actual fact, they just happen to be the right people at the right time who fit into what the plan is. And of course, the purpose of using this new technology is 100% surveillance of the population as part of an overall program of mind control and so on. And people say, oh, this is extreme conspiracy theory or whatever. It's just obvious. It's staring everybody in the face. Incidentally, I find it rather amusing that the Russians, who don't carry out total surveillance, are able, using old-fashioned techniques, to pluck various telephone conversations and put them up on, put them out into the public domain, such as the conversation between Catherine Ashton and Umas Piat, the head of the Estonian Foreign Ministry, about the shootings in the Maidan Square last year, which pointed the finger firmly at the current regime and its backers in the West as being behind the shootings. And the Russians, of course, aren't bugging everybody's telephone calls, they're just bugging Bilderberg's telephone calls. So it's quite possible, and I hope that they have, the Russians have got some bugs in there, because it would be interesting for them to know what's going on, wouldn't it?
Dennis Hassabis, who just mentioned there, this is the Google chap, he's DeepMind, is the Apollo program for artificial intelligence, says the International Business Times. DeepMind's £300 million sale to Google last year, it's just been bought, was explained by saying that the search giant's mission statement of wanting to organise the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. But will it be useful and accessible to us?
Well, I think it's a two-edged sword, because as I said earlier, the contributor in the Panorama programme about the British Army's misbehaviour in Northern Ireland pointed out that in the modern age, everything become a record of everything is created. And so when people say, for example, that we can't trace financial criminals because it's too difficult, I say, well, in the modern world, everybody's emails leave a trace. They just do. And therefore, we could, in fact, turn this technology on our oppressors and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they are, in fact, criminals, and use their own technology to send them to prison for lengthy prison terms.
OK, well, we'll be talking a bit more about Bilderberg in a minute, but one of the background to all of this is the slow descent into financial chaos here in the West with the people who control most of the money in the Western world, many of whom are represented there at Bilderberg in Austria at the moment, and also their links to the arms firms and to these kind of resource grabs. Because Martin, as Michel Jostowski we're just about to hear, he says actually there's global warfare. We're seeing a massive increase in the actual amount of warfare going on different levels in different parts of the world at the moment.
Well, that's because the Anglo-American elite and their Israeli allies cannot accept the growth of the BRICS countries, who are now controlling more and more of the world economy and want a different kind of world order. And the only way they can stop that is by creating as much chaos as possible to undermine their opposition.
So let's have a listen now to Michel Jostowski from the website globalresearch.ca.
Global warfare is now being waged in all major regions of the world in various forms. In some cases, it's theater wars, as in Yemen. In Syria and Iraq, it's a U.S.-sponsored insurgency, the so-called Islamic State. In Latin America, it's a process of destabilization of national economies, but also militarization, the sending in of new Marines to Central America. In Southeast Asia and the Far East, it's the so-called pivot to Asia. It's a situation of provocation largely directed against China. In Ukraine, on Russia's border, it's acts of provocation directed against the Russian Federation and the conquest, essentially, of new frontiers for the global economy. In Africa, it's U.S.-sponsored insurgencies, the destabilization of national economies, the battle for oil. And largely, we're dealing with very powerful corporate actors which control and overshadow the governments. If we wish to give it some kind of structure, we're talking about, of course, the oil companies, the big oil, the Anglo-American oil companies, Wall Street, of course, which is involved in financial destabilization, what President Eisenhower called a military-industrial complex, which are the large defense contractors, the mercenary companies, the intelligence and security corporate apparatus, linked, of course, to the U.S. Military and to NATO. And then, of course, you have the media conglomerates, which are there serving the process of war propaganda, upholding a corporate agenda. And then you also have, and that's very important, you have the biotech conglomerates, big pharma. One dimension of this global war is the destruction and demise of the agricultural cycle. The fact that when you introduce genetically modified seeds into a region such as sub-Saharan Africa, you not only destroy agriculture, but you destroy biodiversity and you undermine the livelihood of an entire region. And that's happening in countries like India. It's happening throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And it is part of that global agenda. The global warfare is not limited to military interventions. It uses covert operations. It also is geared towards destabilizing sovereign governments through so-called colored revolutions, the installation of proxy regimes, which will obey orders, and so on and so forth. It's a very complex process. And we have to connect, in a sense, all the different dimensions of this devastating process, which is destroying countries, transforming sovereign nations into territories, open space for corporations, impoverishing the world population. And that impoverishment is not the consequence of a scarcity of resources. It is the result of manipulation and destruction of economics and social structures and institutions.
Well, that's an interesting conclusion he's got at the end there, Martin, which is that we're being pushed this idea that the world is overpopulated and isn't it terrible? But actually, the reality of it is that what's going on is that resources are being basically hijacked by often, I mean, as we were hearing earlier on in Yemen, you know, there's plenty of food could get through to them, absolutely no problem. It's just that they're being deliberately starved.
Yeah, well, let me make a comment about Chossudovsky so people might not know who he is.
Yeah.
He's an elderly gentleman now, but he was a professor of economics at Ontario University, and I believe he is, in fact, originally of Ukrainian origin, or his family are, and that they went to Canada after the Bolshevik Revolution. And his website, globalresearch.ca, is probably one of the most well-researched websites in the field that we're talking about. He is not just, he is a towering figure in terms of his academic achievements and his political commitment. And you'll find all sorts of things on Global Research. It's not just confined to him. There's all sorts of other contributors.
What about his analysis, though? Because he's saying that there's a whole multidimensional thing going on, and the idea is that they're not really being connected by the press to show where the origins of these are. And a lot of the origins of what he's been talking about there are some of the people that own the ability to do something about this are the Bilderbergers.
Well, that's right. I mean, what we're dealing with is a viciously criminal oligarchy which works outside the law because it's above the law. It shouldn't be, but it is. And they are leading us to destruction. We are sleepwalking to destruction here. If people think that the bombing of Yemen doesn't affect them, they are fools. everything is affecting everything else.
Yeah, why does the bombing? I mean, you know, that does actually seem, well, we should care about it because it's a former British colony, but it doesn't actually affect us at all here.
Well, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, for example, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, are actually making hay while this attack's going on because their main opposition, the Houthis, are being bombed and they are being given a free ride. And in actual fact, the Saudis are dropping weaponry to them to help them to try and deal with their Houthi problem. But these are the people, we are told, who are going to turn up in Bristol and blow us up at Temple Meads. And possibly they will. But when they do, people have got to understand where they came from and their intimate connection with our own security forces. And at some point, we're going to have to read the Riot Act to the people in charge in the West.
But what about the main deal, I suppose, which is the traditional Cold War border between Russia and Europe, which the Bilderberg was set up in 1954, arguably, to drive a wedge between Europe and the Soviets.
Indeed, that's the whole point of what's been going on. The provocations in the Ukraine, as I mentioned earlier, the shootings in the Maidan Square, which began the coup in Kiev. I think the evidence is overwhelming from telephone intercepts and other things that we know that this was actually a bloody coup carried out by Western intelligence services. No doubt MI6 had a hand in it. One of the things I heard was that it was actually British small arms that were used.
Yes,
for the shooting.
We did. We played that clip, didn't we? It was a report on Five Live the morning after the coup, yeah. with somebody who had been over there saying that's what the Ukrainian press was reporting, that it had been British
weapons that had shot the protesters. Indeed. Now, the fact is that they are trying to prevent the perfectly natural growth of economic ties between particularly Germany and Russia. And, of course, we've had two world wars about this relationship. And, of course, the last thing the Americans want is for the Western Europeans to have a prosperous economy based on cooperating with the Russians.
Now, this is the
so, of course, they've now created this war to make sure that that doesn't happen.
There's certainly
they can carry on licking up the cream.
There's certainly brinkmanship going on with the Russians, isn't there? Because, of course, these are nuclear-armed states, and you can't really be... it's one thing, bombing Yemen. People cannot fight you back, but the Russians aren't like that, are they?
No, they're not. But ultimately, the goal is to topple the current regime in Russia, popular as it is, and make them follow policies which are more consistent with what people in the Bilderberg would like to see. The fact is, at one stage, they did impose what they wanted. The Yeltsin era, they imposed pretty much what they wanted. Yeltsin spent most of the time drunk and the rest of the time just agreeing to whatever they wanted.
Or selling off loads of state assets.
But basically handing over state assets to on the cheap. But, of course, ultimately, the Russians managed to pull out of that death dive, and Putin represents the rebuilding of a Russian state which has an independent policy, independent of the Anglo-American elite.
But you pointed out last week...
that's why they've got to be targeted, undermined, and so on.
Well, in the FIFA, for example. But I mean, you said last week, you were talking about if there is some sort of, you know, God forbid, any kind of nuclear confrontation, actually the temptation is on the West to use nuclear weapons first. Why is that?
That's because if you think about the geography of it, and the same is true of the Iranians, if you try and attack Iran or Russia, they are going to have a lot of advantages. And the Russian military, as you know, they've probably been giving advice to the militias in the eastern Ukraine. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But they've managed to turn what was a ragtag army of volunteers into a pretty effective fighting force in pretty short order. And the Ukrainian army has been thrashed, basically. So if it comes to a conventional war, I'm afraid it's going to be Spetsnaz 5, SAS 0. And, of course, at that point, we press the nuclear button. They are threatening the Russians with nuclear first strike. That's why they're moving all of these kind of anti-missile defences right up to the Russian border. And the Russians are aware of this. I think the Russians are remaining rational because, in actual fact, they will be able to strike back. If the NATO generals think that they will get a first strike in on Russia and they won't get hit back, they're fooling themselves. And that's why the Russians are remaining calm, because their deterrent is still there. The Russians have submarines with nuclear weapons on, just as we do. And if even one of those survives, then London is going down if Moscow goes down.
Well, we haven't really been told this, have we, by our mainstream press, the London press, the London media. Anyway, on the nuclear issue, Michel Chossudovsky has a few things to say about that too.
Back in 2002, the US Senate cleared the use of tactical nuclear weapons to be used in the conventional war theater. The whole notion that the commander-in-chief, namely the president of the United States, would actually give the green light, that has been scrapped. These tactical nuclear weapons are part of what they call the military toolbox. They can be used even by a three-star general in the war region, and they're part of the arsenal of conventional warfare. Now, all those things, dimensions, the economic, the social, the military dimensions, coalesce and are sustained by an extensive apparatus of media propaganda. I'm referring to the mainstream media, the corporate media, which sustains the lies and ultimately controls what people think. And this is not an inquisitorial environment. We are dealing with a media apparatus which turns realities upside down, presents the Western quest and military adventure as a peacemaking undertaking, which lies with regard to the casualties of war, which presents the war criminals as protagonists of human rights, and so on and so forth. And that in itself is the pinnacle of this system. It really, without the mainstream media and war propaganda, this New World Order agenda doesn't have a leg to stand on. And in other words, without these media lies, the military agenda, the economic agenda would collapse like a deck of cards. And that is why it is absolutely fundamental that within the realm of independent media and alternative media, we wage a war against the mainstream media. In other words, it's a war of ideas. It is an obligation on our part to support the truth and to use truth as a means, as a weapon, to undermine the legitimacy of this global economic and military agenda, which is destroying humanity.
And here we are, folks, doing exactly that to the best of our ability. Martin, he does say that the media is the pinnacle here. Why is that?
Well, if modern warfare is, Napoleon years ago said moral is to physical as three is to one. Ultimately, war is about psychology. Most battles, even in history, were not won by eliminating entirely the opposition. What happens is you break people's will to resist. You make them think like you want them to think. And you can do that either by intimidating them or by fooling them.
So you're saying,
and of course, fooling them is a much craftier way of doing it than by intimidating.
So you're saying a broadcasting transmitter or a printing press is actually an ultimate weapon of war?
Well, it is. I mean, it's all of these things are linked together. And, of course, it's ultimately about ideas and about information. And, of course, one of the things they really hate is the way in which the alternative media is coming of age in the digital age. But so we've got things like Russia Today, for example, picking up our little efforts here in Bristol and boosting them out to an international audience. And,
well, I don't know if they're rebroadcasting us.
No, they're not rebroadcasting us, but I mean, the point is that they are able to look around all over the world to people who are truth seekers and to give them a much bigger platform than they would otherwise.
I think one of the take homes,
which the Bilderbergers have identified as a major issue,
one of the take homes from all of this is that it's actually no good for people to expect to be told stuff. You've actually got to spend, even if it's a few hours a month, you know, actually online or somewhere else useful, and find out for yourself and verify things for yourself, because the media is not going to tell you the things you really need to know.
And the good news is that it's relatively easy to do. We've stressed on this program many times the Gladio networks of NATO, GLADIO. All you've got to do is put in a Google search and you will find all sorts of information about NATO's terrorist past. Not what it's doing now, what it did in the past. And therefore, we can start to understand and educate people to realise that NATO is not a harmless defensive infrastructure. It never was.
Going back to the Bilderbergs, we've got these various Google people there, and their DeepMind program, which they're talking about at the Bilderberg conference. But then there's also this chap, Peter Thiel, isn't he? He was the financier behind behind Facebook. He's the guy that put the money up for it in the first place. He's quite an interesting guy too. He is actually one of the articles about him in the Telegraph from the 19th of September last year says he's on a mission to cheat death. He wants people to be able to somehow get their personalities into a computer and upload it into the cloud.
Well, it reminds me of the first Chinese emperor who used to take mercury to make himself immortal. These kind of psychopaths and sociopaths often have these kind of delusionary ideas.
The Telegraph says he has got no great interest in music and seldom reads any novels. He's dialed back on his chess playing. In other words, he doesn't do much of that either. But he believes there will be a cure for cancer in the next 20 years. Alzheimer's cure will be happening too. And also immortality, he says, though, may take a little longer, but he certainly believes that it's going to be possible. I mean, these are interesting questions, aren't they? You've got to admit. This is the sort of stuff that will attract some of the people to Bilderberg and think, actually, this is a good conversation. I think it's an interesting one to have. Is it going to be feasible to basically, like, deprogram human genetic material, say we can live forever?
Well, what I read behind this is the traditional oligarchic view that we are the best.
Well, he calls it to survive. He simply calls it the life extension project.
Yes, but it's not going to be for people. All the people who died of basic diseases in southern Africa in the 2 hours of this program. It's nothing to do with them, is it? It's for people like him. And that's what he's interested in.
He's also saying
the usual me agenda.
Immortality may be possible. I mean, you can see why people get attracted to these conferences when this is the thing on discussion.
Well, I imagine this is the chill out room where they're talking this wacky stuff. Meanwhile, the generals and the spies are talking about how they can mash up Yemen, mash up Ukraine, and mash up Syria. The blue skies thinking will no doubt be happening elsewhere.
Okay, so that's one aspect of the Bilderberg. But also another side of this with Facebook and this kind of thing, which Thiel has actually set up. Our government has awarded contracts this week to monitor social media and give Whitehall real-time updates on public opinion. Politicians like to claim they don't care what people say about them. Well, we've always suspected that's untrue. Now we know it is. Ministers yesterday, last week, slipped out an announcement that amid all the spending cuts, agreements just been reached for the first ever cross-Whitehall contract to monitor what people tweet, post and blog about the government.
Yes, indeed. And we've also set up, if you remember, the British Army's Cyber Warfare Battalion, 1,000 plus all officers who are going to spend their time on social media pushing disinformation, all paid for by our taxes. I think that's outrageous. Both them collecting our information about us and also putting their agenda, using taxpayer money to push their agenda. But of course, it's only to be expected. These people are criminals, and they have a criminal enterprise to carry out.
Peter Thiel's also one of the founders of, he's basically a financier of these big tech projects. One of the other things he started was PayPal, and so there's also, of course, in the background here, this is a bit creepy, but the idea of the move towards a cashless society is part of his agenda. He doesn't like the idea of people using cash. He wants people to be using PayPal.
Well, they're going to push for that because when banks collapse and so on, they want to be able to take your money without you being able to keep it in cash. But of course, the other thing that's going on here is that they want all of these internet platforms, things like Twitter, for example, have never actually made any money. So although there's massive share price rises and so on, they've not actually made any money. And I think the dot-com bubble burst in 2000. And of course, at that point, capitalism should have been allowed to work. The dot-com companies should have been put in the dustbin of history because in actual fact, clever as all these things are, they're not actually workable under capitalism. So the internet, in actual fact, is a magnificent place for doing things for free, but it's a useless place for making money. But they got round all of that by simply, 9/11 gave them the excuse, to print money to keep the show on the road. But ultimately, of course, this improvement in the technology cannot actually benefit humanity under a capitalist setup.
The other problem is, of course,
the capitalist setup is going to have to go before we can use this technology to benefit humanity.
If you look at things like PayPal, electronic banking, alongside, you know, this is even things like your whole chip and PIN business, alongside things like the Total Information Awareness Program, which is making sure they've got everybody's passwords, this kind of thing. Mm. It also actually it's opening up the entire system of money to massive amounts of fraud. I mean, if somebody gets a password, they can just go online anonymously, transfer money, and then disappear.
Yes, well, I mean, the point is that all of these technologies also mean that they are creating a record of what they're up to. And if the police service were doing their jobs properly, they would get the warrants required to access the internal communications of these wealthy criminals, and they'd start taking them down.
Well, one of the government people,
utopianism, but as far as I'm concerned, it's the only way to go.
One of the government, I think it was Lord Levy, I'm not sure who, but one of them anyway, who was involved in, I think it was one of the chief government legal officers, he was said to be paranoid about email. So you would just have a conversation face to face. Maybe that's why, you know, everybody is flying there and meeting, because they don't want conversations to be had on email.
Absolutely.
It's the old fashioned way.
Absolutely. And of course, the way round, I mean, the Taliban in Afghanistan, for example, have thrashed the British Army in Helmand Province, despite the fact that they had all the technical communications and modern equipment, not all of the equipment they wanted. But the people fighting them, the way you go around it is just go back to basics. Don't use electronic communications.
Yes, if you want to fight the other forces,
just don't bother with them.
The other message is use cash, guys. Yeah. You know, this is the way. Sweden could be, we see in the Mail Online, could be the first country to go cashless, as even churches now are taking cards for their church offering at the service.
The other aspect of this is it's all dependent upon electronic platforms. So the USS Donald Cook, which was a spy ship in the Black Sea, they came into Russian territorial waters, and the Russians, of course, you've heard of nothing in the Western media about this. We're told when the Russians come close to our territorial waters, this spy ship was right up close to the Black Sea coast. The Russians knocked out all of its electronic warfare capability. And the Russians have been looking at the electronic warfare capability of the West for many years, as have the Chinese, and they've realised that that's actually a vulnerability.
Because
satellites, they can wipe out their electronic.
Companies like Raytheon have been making an absolute fortune selling this to the military, and the military think it's great, but the Russians can just switch it off, basically, with some gizmo.
Well, it's just as well that the Russians can switch it off, because if this technology did give the overwhelming advantage that the NATO generals want, the Russians would have no choice but to start the war now. But because the Russians are quite calm, they realise that if it comes to a war, they've got what they need to teach the other side a lesson. Once you've knocked out the other side's electronic communications, and you're not relying on electronic communications, and you've prepared and trained not to rely on them, then the advantage is going to be with you and not with them.
CNBC, that's Canadian NBC, noted that in Sweden only 3% of transactions now are made with currency.
Well, indeed. I mean, this is the way things are going, isn't it? And, of course, the purpose of this is so that if all cash is made, not legal tender anymore, then you can control the population because you can see everything that they're doing. But by the same token, of course, all these criminal activities that they're involved in will also leave an electronic trace.
Look, if you don't remember, we were hearing from Scott Bennett the other week,
yes,
who'd been following the money going to Islamic rebels. And yes, then as soon as he actually traced it through the Union Bank of Switzerland, I think it was, from the US and from Saudi private individuals that were funding this whole insurgency and the terrorism, as soon as he started to find that, he was basically sacked. So yes, it seems that, you know, this stuff is going on, but if you're clever enough to figure out, even if you're within the military, what's going on, you know, that's it, you lose your job.
Well, we're up against criminals who have a criminal mindset, and they're also very powerful criminals. Nevertheless, they are also defeatable, and ultimately they will be defeated because their goals are inhuman and unsustainable.
Moving back anyway to the Bilderberg vision for the cashless society, Denmark is moving closer to a cashless society, move one step closer to becoming the world's first cashless society. The government is proposing to scrap the obligation for retailers to accept cash as payment.
Well, they may be able to do that in a relatively developed country like Denmark, but I suspect that in places like South Africa, for example, where 40% of the population is unemployed, many people have no electricity at all, and rely entirely upon non-electrical means to heat their food and so on, this stuff just ain't going to run, is it?
Now, the ultimate aim of this, many people say, is to move towards actually an implantable chip, which still exists, and quite a few people in Sweden have now got this. It's basically like a giant injection needle, and it's put into the soft flesh just between your thumb and your forefinger. And as we've heard from a few weeks ago, Dr. Catherine Albrecht has been talking about this. And what's one of the things she's done, she's discovered that actually, although for many people that they wouldn't want a microchip in their body to pay for things with, nowadays, apparently, people are much more ready to accept such a thing.
When I was doing my dissertation research in 2005, I interviewed people about frequent shopper cards at the grocery store. I interviewed them about microchip implants very neutrally, very much saying it's a medical device. Would you take it? And I had about 15% of people say they would, and the other ones were adamantly opposed. I mean, just like over my shotgun kind of answers. Like they were, whoa, I don't, hang on, not me. I'm not trying to do it. But there's been recent research within just the last couple of years that have shown that that number of opposition has gone way down. And now, according to some studies in some parts of the world, it's as high as 50% of people who say that if they could put their smartphone or their cell phone into a tiny implant in their hand, use it to buy and sell, that they would do it.
Really?
So we're now looking at really decreasing levels of opposition. And what I find the most fascinating, Julian, about this is that I grew up, as I said, in the 1970s, where I was exposed to the Mark of the Beast. It was in music on the radio. Right. There were television programs, movies. Everybody knew about it. They talked about it on Sunday in church. Mm. And we've now moved in just a few short decades to a point where even Christians who attend church every Sunday, you'll ask them about the Mark of the Beast, Christian teens, people in their 20s, and they'll say, what is that? Yes. The what of the, huh? So somehow we've lost this 2,000-year-old expectation we were told to watch for. We've lost it, and we're not watching for it.
That's Dr. Catherine Albrecht speaking to Dr. Julian Charles on The Mind Renewed. But Martin, there's an amazing bit of news this week, which I thought was pretty devastating, about the Duke of Windsor. That's Edward VIII, who abdicated before World War II.
Yeah, he was very sympathetic to the Nazis, but as we know, and we've been discussing throughout this programme, elements within the Anglo-American establishment were sympathetic to the Nazis, including Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W. Bush, and they carried on being sympathetic to them during the war, and they continued to cooperate with them after the war, which is why we're facing a crypto-fascist oligarch, a criminal oligarchy today, because it's got a history, a track record, and an intelligence trace.
Well, this specific report is through documents which have been discovered that show that that Edward VIII, after he abdicated, spoke to the Spanish on the 25th of June 1940, saying that actually basically encouraging them to bomb Britain, to bring Britain to the negotiating table, because he thought that they should have an alliance with Germany. And the interesting thing about it, though, is that 2 weeks later, that's when the Luftwaffe bombing campaign of Britain began.
Well, indeed, and of course,
as a former king.
Yes, indeed, and the Queen Mother, bless her cotton socks, was also a great fan of Hitler. Although we didn't hear much about that when she had her massive funeral some years ago, did we?
No, we didn't. But also, also like to just remind folks about a chap called Idris Francis, who we had on this show a few years ago. Idris had an uncle who was in the Royal Artillery, who was escorting guards at Nuremberg. So let's hear from Idris now.
I'm Idris Francis, and having voted yes in 1975, I suddenly woke up in 1992, at the time of Maastricht, to realize what the EU really was. It wasn't a free trade area. It's a political takeover of the continent by people we have never elected and we can't remove. It is a wholly corrupt, dishonest, devious, totalitarian organization, the like of which we have fought against for hundreds of years. And I, for one, am not prepared to put up with it. I set up my own company and I sold out in 1994 to retire to become a full-time nuisance to people who tell lies. My uncle, whom I knew well until he died sadly young in 1960 at the age of 46. I knew him from the early 50s when he used to come down to stay with us in Cardiganshire. very brilliant character who, amongst other things, knew David Niven. But in terms of what actually happened at Nuremberg, he was a major in the Royal Artillery and he was stationed in Hamburg.
What exactly did these German generals say then?
Well, the words as I remember them, yes, you have beaten us again for the second time, but next time we will win. Next time, it'll all happen so slowly you won't realise that it's happening until it's all over.
He is saying that the present empire is basically another version of the Nazis, and the Nazis were bragging about it at Nuremberg. Anyway, we're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Back next week at 5, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the grandmother of missing toddler Ethan Williams...